Before the United States passed the largest climate investment bill in American history, environmental scientist and sustainability expert Dr. Jonathan Foley tweeted this. He said, "I've been working on climate issues for decades, and I have to say that I'm actually more optimistic than ever that we will address it." Yeah, you heard that right. Optimistic was the word he used. And that's for reasons that go way beyond Washington, D.C., right into the offices of CEOs. Dr. Foley is the executive director of Project Drawdown, which is an organization that researches and identifies the most viable global climate solutions. But he says optimism is not the same as hope. Hope is a verb that requires the fight to continue. And Dr. Jonathan Foley joins me now. Hello there.
Hello there. Thanks for having me here today.
And I should say you've been working to combat climate change for around 30 years. Can you tell us how you went from studying other planets to focusing on our one?
Yes. When I went to university, I wanted to be an astronomer and took all those courses in physics and astronomy and all that kind of thing. And ended up taking university courses in meteorology and how the atmospheres of planets worked. And then, of course, dawned on me that, hey, this planet's in real trouble and needs some help. And those other planets are going to be fine. They can wait. And we're not going to get to them anyway. So just kind of a practical shift of also with a childhood love of nature and the outdoors, all kind of clicked together. And so I've been focusing on issues related to climate change and our planet overall for, about 3 decades now.
Yeah, good for you. And there are plenty of non-profits working in the climate change space. We appreciate them all. But what is Drawdown and how is it different?
Yeah, Project Drawdown is a little different because we focus on just one thing. We focus on the on climate solutions, not the climate problem. We already know what the problem is, not on the politics, not on everything else, but just the solutions themselves. So we basically look at the science and the economics and policy kind of underpinnings of which solutions can get us out of this problem, what solutions are best. And we're probably most well known for a book that came out a couple of years ago, simply entitled Drawdown, that outlined 100 different climate solutions where we estimated the potential size of the solution, but also their cost. And nowadays, we're doing a lot more. We're helping to guide politicians and political leaders, but also business leaders and investors and philanthropists to best put forward climate policies and investments and capital to go out and go change the world and go fix this problem. So we're kind of like the a science guide for climate solutions.
My wife often reminds me that dads shouldn't get a round of applause just for taking the kids to school or cleaning up after dinner. With climate change, do we get the same thing on the macro level? Let's not pat ourselves on the back for producing less greenhouse gases. You don't get a gold star for not making global warming worse.
That's a fair point. That many countries in the world, particularly mine, I'm in the United States, but also a lot of Western European countries and others, have enjoyed the benefits of the Industrial Revolution, which grew economies and livelihoods and things that were, very positive for people in these countries, but used a lot of fossil fuels and created a lot of pollution historically in the process. And so, yeah, you're right. We can celebrate or at least acknowledge that countries are beginning to turn things around and reducing their emissions, but we still emitted a lot and we still are. And we also set the stage for other parts of the world to do the same thing after us. And so, yeah, maybe you shouldn't be taking a bow just yet, but I think we can acknowledge progress and be happy about it. Maybe it's less bad as opposed to more good. Either way, I'll take it because we have to get to basically emitting nothing sometime in the next few decades. And the first stop, as they say, the first rule of getting out of a hole is stop digging. And I think we're beginning to do that.
What gave you reason for optimism, even before that U.S. climate bill went to the president's desk for a signature?
Well, it's very interesting because we hear a lot about the climate problem and all the disasters unfolding around the world, which are manifestly awful. And there are so many of them. You can't look around the world without seeing one kind of weather or climate disaster after the other. And these are bad, and they're affecting real people. They're affecting real lives, and people are literally dying in these events. So there's bad news, no question. And I'm not trying to diminish that whatsoever. It is serious. It is dire. But there is some good news, too. And we need to look for it and amplify that. So what's the good news? Well, about 20 to 30, maybe a little bit more, countries in the world are actually reducing their greenhouse gas emissions. And strangely, leading the pack right now, I believe, would be the UK. The UK has cut its greenhouse gas emissions by over 40% since the 1990s. The United States, we cut ours by 20% since 2005, when it peaked basically just before the Great Recession. And we built back our economy and grew our economy and grew our population while simultaneously cutting greenhouse gas emissions. And now our federal government finally is investing in more action on top of that, which might get us closer to 40% 10 years from now. We were on track to maybe cutting emissions by 30% anyway, mainly due to technology and business and local efforts. But now finally Washington's stepping up and doing some of their responsibility and adding another 10%. That's pretty good. Getting to 40% by the end of the 2020s or so is a big deal. That's close to what we need to do for the Paris Accords. And that's just getting started. So I sense a little bit of a snowballing effect here where what we've been doing with markets and technology and businesses have done quite a bit. What states and cities have done, many countries have done. And now some of the more reluctant countries are getting on board and saying, hey, wait a minute, maybe we could actually pull this off. Does that mean everything's fine? No, not at all. China's emissions are still the world's highest and growing a little bit, though I think they'll plateau soon. We have India and other countries still growing their emissions. We have to help that as well. But for the first time, we can see some of the really bad curves start to bend. And I've been at this like 30 years, and the first 29 of those years, I wouldn't have been able to say that. The predictions in the 1990s and 2000s and 2010s were all like, oh my God, it's bad and it's just going to get worse and worse, and nobody gives a damn. Nothing's going to change. And now suddenly things are beginning to change, at least beginning. And that's how change happens, right? As slowly, 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 then all at once. So maybe that's how we'll see change here too. At least that's my strong belief.
I mentioned that phrase of yours, hope is a verb. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a writer named Rebecca Solnit, an American woman who wrote a beautiful book called Hope in the Dark. And she and others point out that hope and optimism aren't necessarily the same thing. Put simply, optimism, you might say, and I don't mean to parse words or be like an English teacher here, but what I mean is you can have a passive belief about optimism. This is, well, I don't have to do anything. It'll just somehow work out okay in the end. And just I'll lean back and I'll just believe that somehow magically everything will be okay. But hope is a almost like it's like love. It's like you have this deep burning desire to make the world better, something you care about so much. You're willing to put it all on the line. It's what motivates change in the world. It's, the belief in hope is to know you may still fail, but you put everything on the line and risk it all just on the chance that you might be wrong and that things could be better. And so one is a verb. Hope, I believe, is the verb of leaning in and being active and risking it all, knowing you could fail, but also maybe knowing you could possibly succeed. And that's what great peoples in the past have done. This is what some of our, ancestors have done in the past. This is what some people around the world today are doing that are just magnificent. Don't you think that, fighting apartheid was a really, Nelson Mandela must have had incredible reservoirs of hope to keep going against insurmountable odds, or Martin Luther King in this country. Some of the biggest transformations in the world looked like they had no chance at all, but somebody had a deep, deep well of hope inside them to keep fighting, to keep going. And that's what we need here. And that's different than, I just am going to sit back and it'll all be okay and I don't have to do anything. That's maybe more a passive belief. I believe in the lean it in active version.
By the way, if you've just tuned in, I'm talking to Dr. Jonathan Foley, the Executive Director of Project Drawdown, an organization that researches and identifies the most viable global climate solutions. And we're talking about why he feels hopeful today about the world's climate crisis. We often hear the phrase follow the money, although we don't often hear it in relation to climate change. But when you do follow the money, what do you see?
Well, I think One strain of that conversation, follow the money, is a very dark path of where oil and gas and, the fossil fuel interest and sort of darker forces, I would say, have been putting a lot of money into stopping climate action and influencing the conversation and trying to slow things down. And there's, trillions of dollars there. So that's one path where you can follow the money. But you can also follow the money that's trying to invest in a better 21st century world where we don't power it with oil and coal and gas and very exploitive kinds of technologies, things that are ruining the world. Instead, people are spending billions and billions of dollars today, not as much as we need to, but it's starting in renewable energy or in more sustainable forms of agriculture or more kind of circular economies, quote unquote, where we, use materials much more wisely and dispose of them much more wisely and reuse them in a much more closed loop kind of thinking. And that's really growing exponentially. And the effects of that are incredible. For example, solar panels today are now the most efficient form of energy and the cheapest form of energy humanity has ever created. Imagine that. Solar energy is now the cheapest form of energy in all human history, followed second by wind. And that's amazing. So these investments, which started off small, maybe a government research lab or somewhere, like in the case of solar, Bell Labs, and then NASA funding these things in the 50s and 60s. But then German policymakers kind of mandating more solar be deployed in Europe, and then Chinese manufacturers figuring out how to make them at huge scales. That lowered the price so much, they're the cheapest form of energy in the world. Nobody would have imagined that even 10 years ago, let alone 20 or 30. Same thing happening with wind, LED lighting, energy storage technologies, now soon electric vehicles and heat pumps. If we're going to solve climate change, I strongly believe we have to beat fossil fuels and bad agriculture in the market. We have to make solutions that are better and safer and cheaper than the alternatives so people choose them without a government mandate. Most Western countries and, well, most people around the world don't really want to be told what to do by a government, but they might choose what to do in a market. And so if you just have the better solution, and believe me, renewable energy is the better solution, it's going to work. It's going to win. And I think that's going to be true in transportation and food and buildings and other things. We're going to just do it better, cheaper, more efficient, better for the environment, but also create jobs and also maybe address equity and injustice issues around the world and make a better world using 21st century tools, not the old colonial powers and power structures and exploitive technologies of the 19th century, still moving through the centuries now. We can do better.
Jonathan, even non-business people will probably be familiar with the SWOT analysis: strength, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. It probably took a long time for our climate change to make it onto the threats board for people to take it seriously. But in fact, you're looking at a different quadrant. You're looking at opportunities. Why is that?
Well, I think it motivates people more and it's more accurate. Yes, climate change is a threat. Just like a disease would be a threat, but you can cure it. And when you cure climate change, not only did you get rid of the disease, you ended up with a better world. Tell me a medical intervention that not only cures you of disease, but makes you richer, better looking, and happier when you're done. But that's what climate change solutions could do. It's really about reinventing the world and kind of ripping the world away from the, we're being held hostage by, really terrible kind of power structures and exploitive technologies that are doing things the way they used to be done only for money. The way we're powering the world today, the way we do things in industry, the way we grow our food and use our food and materials is insane, is not a sustainable, viable, or equitable, or just, or even, decent way to run a planet. And guess what? We have an alternative. We eventually have to choose this alternative, a better way to power a civilization, better ways to grow food and live our lives, all these things. And we will. Why don't, if I were a business person, I'd want to be ahead of the curve on this. It's the biggest business opportunity in human history. It's also the biggest civilization history, opportunity in our history to build a better world. A lot of people look at climate change as like, oh, wow, we have to address this problem. I'm like, yes, we do. But we also get to. It is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to just reinvent the world and reboot it and make it better. And I think the world, look around. I think the world could stand a bit of a reboot.
You mentioned energy, probably more relevant here in New Zealand in terms of our impact on climate change is agriculture. It's the largest sector of our tradable economy. And you've called food production the other inconvenient truth. It doesn't get the attention that energy production does, but perhaps could you tell us why should it?
Well, it definitely should get more attention than it does in many parts of the world. And yes, of course, New Zealand and many countries, agriculture is going to be one of the primary greenhouse gas issues. And yet we still all have to eat, and agriculture is essential for us as a civilization. But we need to do it better. Today, globally, not New Zealand, but the world as a whole, the world's greenhouse gases come about one quarter from making electricity and about one quarter from making food. They're roughly equal. And yet, in most of the world's media attention or policymaking or all these climate conferences, the electricity people get a lot more attention because, they have smokestacks and things like that. Coal power plants, very easy to see the pollution. It's a lot harder to see pollution coming from farms or from animals or from forests, but they do. And that's a tough conversation to have, also because I think agriculture is kind of woven into our civil discourse and our ways of thinking about ourselves, our ways of life. And so changing the way of life of a people, their own identity, is hard. It's a harder conversation than, hey, we used to burn coal in that power plant. Now I want to flip it to a wind turbine. That's pretty easy compared to reimagining the landscape and what people have been doing for maybe generations. But we do need to do that. But in agriculture, the big culprits are mainly deforestation is still number one on that list, especially in places like Brazil and Indonesia. But second would be ruminant agriculture, the critters that burp methane like sheep and cattle. And you have quite a few sheep in New Zealand, and so do a lot of other places. Here, it's mostly the cattle problem, and that's a really hard conversation to have, for many reasons: cultural, political, economic, and environmental. So I think we have to have that conversation and look for the best possible solutions overall. But I have to acknowledge that's a tough one. It's a very hard conversation. But food waste, shifting diets, things like this are part of the answer. And maybe new technologies in agriculture to produce animal agricultural products better, especially from cattle and sheep, meat and dairy kinds of things have to be done better. We just simply have to do that. But it's a hard conversation. There's no way around it.
Yeah, it might not be that sexy tech solution, right? When it comes to agriculture, in the same way that the energy solutions are often technical innovations, it might be a bit of a buffet, a little bit of this and a little bit of that, a bit of lifestyle change required.
Well, that's right. I mean, we in our analysis of Project Drawdown, again, this is a global analysis, not specific to like New Zealand or the Netherlands or anywhere in particular. But we argue that like food waste, where 30 to 40% of all the world's food is not even eaten, that's a really good lever to be looking at because no one is in favor of food waste. Well, I've never met the people from the food waste lobby. I don't know who they are. But food waste, we lose food and we lose environmental impacts. That way people lose money. Surely we could do something about that, especially in meat and dairy products. And then secondly, is shifting to more plant-based diets. We do not suggest at all that everyone in the world should become vegan because there are many people in the world who simply wouldn't. But many in the world who depend on animal agriculture for food security and livelihoods, especially in low and middle income countries. So maybe it's a more nuanced answer. It's not just black and white, but shifting food waste lower and shifting to a little bit more plant-based mixtures of diets would help a lot. And then grow the food we do eat more sustainably on less land with fewer emissions and while we're protecting ecosystems, especially our forest and peatlands and other sensitive ecosystems. But the good news is between growing food better and wasting it less and being more efficient overall, there's ample space to have a better food system with a lighter footprint on the planet while still feeding 8 billion people and growing just fine. We just have to do it better, and we can.
I always notice that our listeners feel particularly motivated after a conversation like this. So, can I take advantage of having you on the line, Jonathan, and ask you, what is your message to the individual? What does a good life look like in 2022 for someone who is committed to being part of these solutions?
Well, absolutely. I mean, individuals are critical for climate action. While we still need, of course, change at the political level and in business and investing, you're part of those systems too. So by voting, by thinking about where you maybe invest your own money in the bank or in retirement funds, that kind of thing is really crucial. How you work within your com the company you work for, or your employer, how does that, we have a saying at Project Drawdown, every job is a climate job. So those are really important things to do, is have these conversations in your community, think about this in your political actions and how you participate in your democracy, how you participate in your workplace, your school, your communities, your places of worship and education, whatever. And of course, in our homes, we're reducing food waste, making sure we don't just throw food away is one of the top things individuals can help do. Also, maybe eating a few more plants and a few, fewer animals in our diet mix, but you choose, but that would be helpful to you and maybe your health and the environment at the same time. And also looking for opportunities for up energy efficiency upgrades the next time you have to remodel your home or think of a new vehicle. Try to get the most efficient version and maybe the one that runs mostly on electricity so it can be powered with renewables in the long run. Those are all things we can do. And I don't like to guilt people. I don't know if it translates to New Zealand English or not, but I don't want to see a guilt trip, but think of it as a power trip. Hey, I get to change my diet. I get to save money at home. I get to be more energy independent, and I get to have better politicians, and I get to work in better places and have better communities. This is great. It's not your fault that there's climate change, but we do need your help and your agency and your work. So, everybody can be involved in climate change in a positive, very can-do kind of way. And I would encourage everyone to think about how they can do that, especially in ways that make your life better, because it will.
A great, refreshing chat, Jonathan. We haven't taken the message from you that everything is okay. We're not going to walk away from this thinking that that we don't need to continue acting. But it's lovely to spend 20 or 30 minutes focusing on what's gone right and hearing the news that actually you see progress and you see reason for optimism. So thanks for your time today and for the ongoing work you do at Project Drawdown.
Well, thank you. And as we like to say around here, it's not game over, it's game on. It's time to get busy and solve this problem and build a better world. And this is the most important time in human history to hear that message and to step up and do the work.